All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And welcome to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone, your host on WHAM 1600 AM. We're happy that you've joined us today. We have two great interviews to talk about. One is with Shelley Rood, a veteran who is also a woman's entrepreneur and focusing on women who kick butt. Our second interview today will be with an Eastern Michigan University professor, Gary Peterson, who is going to tell you a story you've never heard about, I'm sure, about Victory Verticals and the Steinway Piano Company and its efforts during World War II. But before we get started, we want to tell you to visit and thank our sponsors. The Vietnam Veterans of America, Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The American Legion Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and U.S. Wings, as well as VFW Post 423, the Graf O'Hara VFW Post in Ann Arbor, as well as Legal Help for Veterans. We appreciate all of their support, which allows us to bring you Veterans Radio every week, to keep its Facebook active, to undertake our very active podcast series that get posted every Tuesday at 11 a.m. So we hope you go to veteransradio.net and click on our sponsor banners, as well as listen to our podcasts, stay in touch with us on Facebook, and be back here on WHAM 1600 every Sunday at 5 p.m. Now let's talk to Shelley Rood of Mission Ambition. Shelley Rood, an Army veteran. Shelley, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. It's my honor to be a part of the show today.
Well, we're glad to have you on to bring a different perspective. That's what we try to do on Veterans Radio, is give a lot of different perspectives about veterans and their service and their integration back into civilian life. And you're doing some cool things, so we wanted to get you out there. But let's start with how did you find your way into the military?
Oh, it's a twisted path, actually. So I didn't even know that anyone in my family ever served in the military until I said, hey, I'm going to join the Army. And then all of a sudden I discovered that both of my grandfathers had served and, you know, that we did have a lineage behind us. But it was never something that was talked about. When I was in high school, I graduated at the age of 19. I went to Western Michigan University, and I was scared to death of the freshman 15. That's where, you know, the really attractive women go off and they come back 15 pounds heavier. And I was so shallow and so vain at that point in my life that I joined ROTC because they had an outdoor survival skills program, and I thought, this will keep me in shape.
Well, you found a lot more than just running and calisthenics in ROTC. How were your experiences with ROTC?
Absolutely. And, you know, even just that one class, I had no ambitions whatsoever to join. But through that class, I got introduced to the Bronco Rifle Team, which is 22 small bore caliber shooting. And it turns out that I am a phenomenal shot. Who would have known? So I actually made my way into being the captain of the rifle team, and the rifle team is run by the ROTC department. And really just seeing the juxtaposition between your normal college student and the Greek life, with those of us that are in the ROTC program, those that were joining the military when they graduated, you know, things like duty, honor, selfless service, respect, those values were so deeply ingrained in them, and that's how I was raised. And it was so attractive to be around such inspiring people that, you know, over a couple of semesters, a couple of years there, I thought, why am I not? You look at what the incredible people are doing. I need to be jumping on this train. And I did. So by the time I was a junior at Western Michigan, I went ahead and signed up I continued 2 years as an SMP cadet, so that means that you serve in the Army Reserves while you're also a cadet in school. And then once I graduated, I served 16 years in the Army Reserves.
It's sort of interesting. We hear from a lot of people who joined ROTC because they needed the money for school. You approached it differently and sort of got pulled into it because you said, geez, my values, they're right in a line with this group of folks, and maybe this is something I'm very comfortable with. So you didn't go after it because it was a way to get college paid for. That's interesting.
Yeah, no, I was raised with a family of, you know, Detroit business owners. I worked construction. I paid my way through college. My parents helped me out because they saved their money so that they could. To this day, you know, I just finished my first year in seminary, which is a master's program, and I'm debt free. And I do it because I believe that money is a resource from God and He gives it to us. And we are charged with proper management and proper investment of it. And so, no, I didn't join the military for monetary purposes. I've always been confident in my ability to make things happen in that world. It really was a matter of what do I want to be with my life and who do I want to be around and partner with to make great things happen.
So tell us a little bit about your 16-year career.
Well, I've been in over 10 different units. I was actually married to an active duty Army Ranger. Those are very wonderful men, very difficult men. I'm just teasing.
After
9 years of marriage. Yeah. Oh, it's so true. But, you know, after 9 years of marriage, we are one of those that didn't make it. We didn't. You know, you got a couple deployments in there. We had the birth of a child in there. And we just grew completely apart, different paths, different values. So I've been through the struggles on all sides of it, and trying to hold down a military career and trying to hold down a successful civilian career. You know, so my military career never really had the opportunity to take the front lines. I'm jealous of those of you veterans that had the opportunity to say, yes, I committed 4 years active duty, 8 years active duty, you know, 25 years active duty. I think that's incredible. The Army never gave me that opportunity. I tried to go active duty at multiple points in my career, and the reserves kept saying, no, we need you reserve.
Well, and there certainly is a role for our reserve and National Guard components. I think sometimes they get downplayed, but unfortunately over the last decade or two, the importance of those roles have been highlighted with those who've received orders maybe for a year at a time or more to Afghanistan or somewhere else in the sandbox. So the Guard and Reserve are really key components to our military strength and strategy. And I suspect that you felt that way spending 16 years in the Army Reserves.
And, you know, Jim, you couldn't be more right. It's a hot-button topic for me. There's a lot of veterans out there who believe that you can't or couldn't claim veteran status unless you have those active duty years. You know, and it's been a joy for me to represent the other side of it, of saying for 16 years of my life, it's been interrupted by constant training, constant drills, always gone. You know, I spent 6 months of my life out at Fort Huachuca at one point, only to turn around and go back 2 weeks, come home, then turn around and go back for 2 weeks. You know, and for somebody to say that I haven't served my country or I've served it lesser than some of us who are on the same team, it's a really difficult fight to talk. So, you know, for anybody who kind of has those hesitations or genuinely thinks that reservists and National Guardists are at a lower level than they've served, I just want to encourage them to have open conversations about the challenges that we face because they're very different and they're very unique. And I don't think that we should have to apologize that our country did not call us up.
Well, and I think that distinction may have had more meaning 3 or 4 or 5 decades ago, but certainly, as I say, in the last 2 decades, it's a meaningless distinction in my mind. And unfortunately, Congress, the VA, way it defines categories of people, have kept that distinction alive. And I think that's unfortunate.
So it is. It's very politically driven and very money driven. You're absolutely correct.
So as somebody who spent that time in the reserves both on bases as well as one of the other challenges of reserve and guard folk is that, you know, they're in the community. How did you see the perception of people change, if at all, about a woman being in the military during your career?
That's such a great question. You know, as a career woman also, you know, I'm kind of like fighting to have a strong foothold here in so many different areas of life. As a woman in the military, you know, I will say this, I feel like more opportunity was handed to me in my military positions because it wasn't ever a question of can she do the job. You are expected to do the job. When you have the rank, when you have the title, when you have the position, you know, you will do it. It's not a matter of can you or are you capable. Whereas in the civilian side, it's almost like you're constantly proving. As an entrepreneur and a business owner, I will never work for corporate again because I am horribly frustrated with trying to prove myself, trying to earn that promotion, right? Trying to get that next level raise. And I'm just over it. You know, it's so great to be so accomplished and at this point in my life where I know the value and I know my service. And I can really just take pride in so many of the accomplishments and what the meaning of life is really all about.
Well, I think it's a very interesting time to be a veteran entrepreneur with so many men and women coming out of service and active duty deployments and others to say, yeah, you know, I'm not going to go work for the man anymore. I've done that. I'm now marching to my own drum. And get into the business world and become an entrepreneur in a small business way to take care of your family. I think this is the, you know, will be looked back on as the golden time to do that. Tell us a little bit about how you decided, hey, there's enough support out there and there's enough opportunity out there. I'm going to start my own business and go in that direction.
So I actually have a 7-year broadcast television career in my past as the director of marketing and brand management for a number of TV stations down south. And I also have a 5-year fitness industry career, both working, you know, on the low end of being a personal trainer to learn the industry all the way up to gym management and region management and just business consulting. So through all of that experience, really recognizing that even if somebody else writes my paycheck, it's still my paycheck. And I actually started my own business many years ago, but never attached the veteran or the military title to it. So I dug my way through the business world, you know, successfully, but to a point. I kept feeling like I wasn't breaking through. I wasn't making a difference. Maybe I'm just, you know, not good enough in business yet, and maybe there's other things I still need to learn. And I'll be honest with you, Jim, it was another veteran who I inspired to own her veteran title that she told me I needed to own it a little bit more. And then as soon as I did that, I slapped the veteran and military title onto my company, and it has been night and day. And I wrestle with it because it's very important that being veteran and being military is not a novelty. You know, we're not a promotional ham to be thrown around, but at the same time, that's where opportunities come from. And I genuinely struggle with it. You know, I was just talking with another group of veterans earlier this afternoon about how you go to restaurants and they have a special menu and they say a certain percentage of it goes back to vets or whatever. And then you look and it's like half of the percentage of profit, right? So you're using me as a marketing ploy. You're not helping me. Whereas, you know, on the veteran side of it, it's a right to be able to claim, like, yes, I am a veteran, and yes, I am helping other military people with how I'm giving back to the world through my business.
Well, I think many veterans, and it sounds like you and me included, feel somewhat uncomfortable saying, hey, we're a veteran, and that should give us some status. But largely, I think it's more about, you mentioned, you know, brand marketing and things. And when you say you're a Western Michigan Bronco, I have a certain image of your experiences. And when you tell me you're an Army vet and you were in the reserves for that long, I have another image of what that means, what qualities you must bring to the table. And I think that's what you have to get comfortable with. Do you find veterans having a challenge getting comfortable with that?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And, you know, Jim, here's the hard line that I like to talk about. It's not about yourself. It's about the other people in the world. My life genuinely stands for serving others first, putting others over yourself, however you define that, whatever that looks like. If you don't have a solid conception of your personal identity, if you're not owning the experiences of your life, then you're still being selfish. You're still being self-centered. Once you really grasp that, then you'd be so surprised at how much you can really pour out to other people.
Well, you know, we're veteran radio listeners, we are talking to Shelley Rood, who's the co-founder of Mission Ambition. Shelley, tell us about Mission Ambition.
So Mission Ambition is my head company. It's the big one. It's the umbrella of consulting that everything, all my fun entrepreneurial projects can fall under. Mission Ambition is, I'm a public speaker. I love the stage. I love the crowd. It's a gift from God to be able to stand up there and not be nervous, right? It's all about the message that comes through me. So from public speaking to any types of workshops, training, I speak on women empowerment, leadership, sales training. So through that, I really have created a platform for myself of where do we go from here, right? And I started to collect a following of other women, and there was something that these women had in common. They are kick-butt women just like me. They're female firefighters and police officers. They would come hear me talk, and then they'd follow me, and they're business owners, they're donut shop owners, they're doctors and lawyers, but they love the strong woman that I represent, right? And so we decided last year that we were really going to give them a home. So we developed a community called Mycelia. And Mycelia is Latin for a group of missiles. And we define ourselves as women who kick butt. You do not have to show your DD-214 to join Mycelia. You know, your mother, if your mother is a kick butt woman, she is welcome in the group. But, it's really created as a way to form mental resiliency amongst our American heroes. A couple of statistics I'll throw out at you. 42% of female veterans say that they don't feel respected and valued. That breaks my heart. I hate that statistic. I don't understand that statistic. How come when you call 911 and the strong female grabs her gun and runs out the door to save your life, why does she not feel respected and valued? Another statistic I'll throw out at you has to do with the suicide rates. A female veteran suicide rate is double that of a civilian woman. There's something genuinely amiss amongst our heroes. And I think it really comes down to this idea of embodying the self-identity that it's okay to be a strong woman. You don't have to have 16 pounds of makeup in your car to define you as a woman. And Mycelia does just that. It brings all the women together, and we support it through a subscription box. So this is like a Birch Box or a Bark Box, something that is delivered to your door every month. We put beauty items and tactical items in the boxes. And the best part about the boxes, Jim, is that we actually share the story of one of our members. We feature her every month. She's called our Mycelette. And she doesn't have to be, you know, a service member. We've done police officers. We've done Vicky Rad for last month, for the month of December. She is one of the former presidents of the group Women in Defense. She's never served a day in her life, and yet her entire civilian career has been dedicated to the defense industry of America. She deserves an award.
Well, I think it's really necessary for people to get out and talk about this, really a disconnect that women veterans would have such a high suicide rate compared to those in the civilian world, or that such a high percentage of them would not feel the respect or honor that they deserve, that they earned by their service. Do you have an explanation for why this is, Shelley?
You know, Jim, we don't fit in. You know, when I go to, like, a women's networking group is the most awkward thing for me to go to. We don't fit in. No matter where we go, it's like we don't fit in. We fit in with the guys. We fit in at an MMA fight. You know, we're just a different type of woman. And it's not to take away from other types of women. It's just that we are who we are. And I feel like a lot of times we feel very ostracized from how society wants us to behave. And that exists even within the military. You know, that's why those statistics are so high. I will tell you personally, some of just the most demeaning comments that I've had said to me as a woman businesswoman have come from fellow veterans, and those hurt even more. You know, I had, you know, people make silly comments like someone handed me something and called me peepers because I have big eyes. You know, it's just, it's an inappropriate comment at an inappropriate place. It's a networking meeting. You know, I don't know why certain people feel like they can get away with saying things off the cuff like that. And it comes back to this feeling of, it's almost like we have to fight just to exist. Why should we have to fight just to be who we are?
Well, I think there's a lot of cultural issues and stereotypes that sort of get magnified under the heat and pressure of military service. Clearly does not justify it, but it tries to explain it a little bit. We see it in the service academies. We see it in the enlisted ranks. We see it in the officer ranks. And I think you have to talk about it and call it out if you're going to.
Oh, you do.
If you're going to break that cultural stereotype and let that pressure and heat, you know, dissipate or go in another direction, not to keep causing this. So, I think it's great that you're out talking about these issues and encouraging other strong women who kick butt to, hey, talk about it too, and don't feel that they have to change their own self, their own personality, to sort of fit in.
Absolutely. And, you know, Jim, it's a fun conversation to have. It really is. You know, the civilian population, when they think of the American soldier, they think of Captain America, right? And when they learn the stories about those of us that have been in, I mean, we're dirty, we're gritty, we sin like no other. And that's the reality of what it means to be a part of the military culture. And to a civilian, they can't understand that. They can't grasp that. They think, well, why are they so dirty? Why are they so gritty? You know, they're supposed to be Captain America. And the answer to that is, in reality, we're fighting wars. We are asked to do things that no human being should be asked to do, but it's biblical, and we stand up for it, and we take the punch, and we go into the fight. And it plays, you know, games with your mind, and there's so much spiritual warfare that goes on inside of us that most people can never understand. And it truly comes down to what you do with this radio program and what so many of our good veterans who are working in mental health field really are trying to do. It's just, let's talk about it. It's okay that you're broken. It's okay that you're weird. It's okay that you're harsh. Let's just talk about it, because we still love you and you still have a place in the world.
We've had a number of guests on Veterans Radio, Shelley Rood, who's the owner of Mission Ambition. We've had a number of guests, Shelley, who've talked about sort of that moral injury of war or having to prepare for war. And while I don't want to head necessarily down a whole other conversation with you, it sounds like some of that, solving some of that for yourself, has been more education, moving into the seminary, sort of getting right with things from a more spiritual perspective.
Yes. You know, one thing that was really striking to me just recently, within the last year in my reserve unit, you know, we got to re-up for our dog tag. So you go up to the list, there's hundreds of names. You put your name down, you put your service number down, and you put your religion down. Jim, I was floored that out of the hundreds of names, maybe five people actually put something down for religion. That doesn't show me that we're not a religious community. That shows me that there's a lot of people who are lost, who are not asking the questions.
Well, I think there's a whole other conversation we can have around that issue in the future, and I think we will. Shelley Rood of Mission Ambition, if people want to find out some more about what you're up to or your projects, how do they keep in touch and find that out?
I'm not hiding. You can Google me. It's Shelleyrood. You can find any number of media hits, podcasts, webcasts, and things that I've been on, just like tonight. The website is missionambition.org, and those gift boxes, that women's community, is missilia.us. That's missilia.us. Thank you for having me, Jim. It's been an absolute honor.
Well, we're glad that you were able to spend some time with Veterans Radio today, and keep up the fight for all women who kick butt.
I certainly hope you enjoyed hearing the perspective of a U.S. Army veteran, a woman who brings a unique perspective to the conversation. I think we probably all learned a little something, and we all ought to give a little more respect and a little more acknowledgement to our sister veterans who are out there. I know I'm married to one and who's still strongly fighting for veterans all the time in every location. So I think we all ought to be doing that for our female veterans. So let me bring you a word from our sponsor, and then after the news, we'll be talking to Gary Peterson on the Victory Vertical Project by the Steinway Music Company. Very fascinating story. You've never heard it before. I know Dale's going to be a little jealous on this because he usually brings the musical stories to Veterans Radio here on WHAM 1600. But I'm lucky to have the opportunity to bring this one to you. This will be particularly interesting for any Eastern Michigan University music students or those who've attended concerts there because we're talking to a EMU professor. So again, stay tuned after the news.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio. Thanks for tuning back in to listen to our interview with Dr. Gary Peterson of Eastern Michigan University. I am Jim Fossone and happy to be your host this afternoon on WHAM 1600 AM Talk Radio. We on Veterans Radio really appreciate this opportunity to bring you stories about veterans and stories that may be of interest to veterans. This one in particular will be of interest to World War II enthusiasts, music enthusiasts, and those who are just fascinated by little bits of history that get lost but can be found. And that's what we're bringing you today. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Dr. Gary Peterson. He's a professor of music at Eastern Michigan University. And he has spent the last couple of years developing a very interesting project called the Victory Vertical Piano Project. After 25 years of teaching music, he stumbled on something that's going to make us all go, I didn't know that. Gary, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, let's set this up a little bit. You are a professor of music. You are a concert pianist. You have had a performance career all over the world. And one of the things that you are, I don't know the right lingo, I'll call it title, is you are a Steinway artist. Can you explain a little bit of what that is for our listeners who may not be so musically inclined?
Well, the Steinway piano is, in my opinion, the piano par excellence in the world today. I would say most concert halls and most symphony orchestras use Steinway pianos for their soloists. And to become a Steinway artist, you have to be nominated by Steinway. I actually received the notification that I was being considered on my birthday a number of years ago, just by happenstance, and then was invited to present a program at Steinway Hall in New York City where I was inducted into this roster. What it really means is honorary. There are some advantages. For instance, when I go to a city to play, Steinway often provides me an instrument. When I need a place to practice, I can call a Steinway dealership and they will find me a place to work when I'm not near home. And I'm just honored to be among this roster that includes you know, Horowitz and Rubinstein and Rachmaninoff and the greats of all time.
Well, it's a wonderful professional distinction, and we're talking about it, listeners, as we talk to Dr. Garrick Peterson of Eastern Michigan University and his distinction as a Steinway artist, because it's how you, if you will, stumbled upon the Victory Vertical Piano Project. Tell us how this came about.
Well, I had, in 2008, one perfect day. I was flown to New York City in the morning and taken to the Steinway factory to pick out a new piano for my studio. And I had, you know, 11 pianos to choose from, but there turned out that there was one that was just calling my name. And so before noon, I had selected my piano, and I was invited to go then to Manhattan to Steinway Hall. And it just happened that Mr. Henry Z. Steinway was in his office today and invited me in for a visit, which to me was one of the great honors of my life. But it speaks to his graciousness, because I said that when I walked in, and he said, "Oh, that's nonsense. I'm just a craftsman. You're the artist." And he was just a lovely, lovely man.
And Mr. Steinway at that point was 93 years old.
Correct.
And,
correct.
And when faced with somebody who's so legendary in his field, and me, in his humble words, just a craftsman, you asked what seemed like a you know, very normal question. Hey, in this long career of yours, what are you most proud of? You didn't get the answer you thought you were going to get, did you?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I expected, you know, some of his associations with the great pianists of the 20th century. And he thought for a moment, and he said, you know, during World War II, we were prevented by the War Production Board from continuing our production of pianos. And we got an idea that the men in the field need music, they need pianos, they need something that will lift their morale. And so we went to the military and pitched this idea to make some humble little pianos that could withstand battlefield conditions. And lo and behold, they bought it. And so the Steinway was the only piano builder that was building pianos during the first, you know, several years of the war, and they were building them for the military.
Well, it's really an interesting idea, and it shows how the times have changed, right? In the 1940s, playing the piano and reading sheet music was something that was widely done, and Mr. Steinway wanted to make sure that, as you say, the morale of the troops could be lifted, but you can't ship a standard size piano all around the world. Tell us a little bit about what he designed and what he had built.
Well, actually, you can. In terms of the keyboard, this is a standard sized piano. It was 40 inches tall. And the main adjustments were made both for ease in moving the piano around and in withstanding conditions that it was going to have to withstand, and the use of restricted materials like copper, brass, that were needed for the war effort. And so there were quite a few adjustments that had to be made, but they went to work and came up with a little piano that they could produce for this purpose.
Well, I think the next thought our listeners are probably having, Dr. Peterson, is how do you ship these things around? Anybody who's anybody who's tried to move a piano has probably thrown their back out. But talk a little bit about sort of how did they distribute these pianos?
Well, the first thing they did was they created a crate. And Henry told me that he said, you know, we were building caskets at the time, and I looked at one of those caskets, and I thought, you know, if we made one of those basically a little bit bigger, maybe we could pack a piano inside it. And they were very, very well packed, to the extent that some of the pianos were actually airdropped to troops on the field. So they were dropped by parachute with other supplies in these crates. They were also relatively lightweight for an upright piano, and they had built-in handles, so they could easily be picked up and moved and almost thrown around if there were four handles on them, so four men could easily pick it up and put it wherever it needed to be.
Well, talk a little bit about the piano-playing public at that point in time. Gary, and I guess in particular, what we would have expected from the troops who would have received these pianos.
Well, you know, the piano was the musical instrument par excellence in the 1940s. At the beginning of the war, just about every home had a piano, and a piano was used for every kind of music making that was done, whether it was patriotic music, popular songs, jazz, classical music, just about everything used a piano. And so whether they were music readers or people who just sat at the piano and fiddled, or you know, fiddled around, men who played by ear. The letters that have come in through the years tell us that these pianos were played night and day. Once they arrived, there was always someone to play them, and there were many others to gather around and listen and sing and just enjoy the music making.
Gary, how many of these types of Victory Vertical pianos did Steinway produce during the war effort?
Exactly 2,436.
And where did they go? Did they just go to Europe? Did they just stay in the United States? Where did they go?
They went to every theater of the war. They found, I was just reading this morning about one that made its way to Australia. I've known of one that was found in Asia, in China. Many in Europe, Northern Africa, they truly, and then USO shows and bases all around the United States and Canada. I mean, really, they circled the globe.
And these pianos would have, obviously, those are all different conditions, and they're a whole lot different than the concert halls that you as a trained pianist play in. Did they have to accommodate the conditions that they anticipated the pianos would be subjected to?
Oh, absolutely. There are so many adjustments that had to be made. First of all, the soundboard was twice baked. You know, it was really, really prepared for all kinds of humidity. There were brass screws that actually screwed the soundboard to the frame of the piano, because they just knew, especially in the South Pacific, that they would warp and pull away. There were all kinds of insect treatments, for instance, to the felt and the parts of the piano that could be consumed by insects. They in those days they still used ivory keys, but ivory would not hold up, and so they developed a celluloid key top, and so just a lot of adjustments. Steinway was pretty ingenious in meeting all the requirements of the War Production Board.
Well, it really shows sort of, American ingenuity to mm-hmm. modify the piano for the conditions it was going to face. And you just wouldn't think of this unless some expert like you was explaining it. But I have to ask, now we've all seen, you know, these beautiful black lacquered Steinways, or maybe they're white or some other color. What was the outer appearance of these vertical Victory pianos?
Well, one letter I read, a young GI is writing home about the arrival of an Army GI piano, and he said, "We took it off the Jeep, and it was exactly the same color as the Jeep." So the Army pianos were olive drab. The Navy pianos were gray. The military was very specific about what color they needed to be.
And those of us who served can just absolutely envision this, that you'd take this beautiful instrument and, by God, everything's got to be olive drab, you know, or everything's got to be on a ship, everything's got to be gray. So that is the Department of Defense way. I want to make sure everybody understood. They didn't change the rules here. They applied the rules to these field pianos. How was the music communicated, Professor Peterson? Would guys have their own sheet music? Would they get sheet music in the location? How did they get the music to play?
The music was actually packed, crated with the piano, and every crate contained a similar assortment, but various, you know, differences. But it contained an assortment of sheet music, Protestant hymns, popular music, patriotic music, some classical pieces, especially swing, jazz, but various kinds of jazz, boogie woogie, just what they really believed that the soldiers would consume as soon as they opened it, and that seems to be what happened.
Well, it's a very, again, you can sort of see how different types of music would fit different circumstances for the troops, and probably different players' skill levels, I would assume, as well.
Yes, yes.
And so you have this conversation with Henry Steinway, and you go back home, and how does this, infect your life?
Well, I truly didn't have any idea how it was going to, you know, affect my life at the time. First of all, because I was almost, I was so surprised. You know, I have a doctorate in music. I'm supposed to know everything. And I had never heard of this. And so I came home and I started telling people what Mr. Steinway had told me. And lo and behold, nobody knows this story. And so I just got more and more interested. I started visiting the Steinway Archives in Queens, New York, and seeing what I could find about this project. And I gradually decided, you know, that I needed to tell this, that this is not only an important piece of history, but it's also important for us to know today.
Well, I think it's also one of those stories where when you start hearing it, you can see this intersection of music, entertainment, morale, the war effort, coming together in a way that makes so much sense when somebody explains it to you, but I would never have guessed it without having had the good fortune of hearing you present your program, the Victory Vertical Piano Project, where you intersperse both the history and the pictures of this, but also the actual music that was likely played. And maybe you can talk about some of your favorite selections that actually get played when you do the project yourself.
Well, sure. I include some patriotic numbers, of course. I'm sure that during World War II, the Star Spangled Banner was included in any event that happened anywhere. And so I play things like that. I often play the patriotic medley of the Armed Forces theme songs. I start the story with a well-known boogie-woogie version of Chattanooga Choo Choo, which was number one on the charts when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and also was the name of a bombing campaign in Western Europe that was extremely successful in cutting off all the communication there. I play classical pieces like the music of Samuel Barber, who was went through basic training, and they discovered that he was a celebrated composer, and they said, the best thing you can do, we're going to send you home and we want you to write American music, because this war is not only a war of military might, but it's a war of ideas. And we need to be able to get our ideas, our American ideals out to the world. And so I play that. I play, of course, Glenn Miller's wonderful signature tune, Moonlight Serenade, wonderful figure who tried to get in the service, and they told him he was too old, and he just came back and tried again, and finally they took him, and after not too long, he went down probably in the English Channel when he was on his way to present a program to the troops. I play a piece by a Michigan composer, Ross Lee Finney, who was a war hero and also the chair of composition at the University of Michigan when he came back from the war. But he came back after having stepped on a landmine, and he was suffering from what we today call post-traumatic stress. And so this is a piece that shows really that deep effect that war experiences have on soldiers after they come back, and his working through those issues.
I want to say that again, the music interlude, the way you do this is just fantastic. I want to encourage all our Veteran Radio listeners to take the opportunity to check out your website, and maybe you can give us the website that folks can go to follow on where you are performing and learn more about these Steinway Victory Verticals.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jim. The website is victoryvertical.com. No spaces, no caps.
And you've been able to perform this not only in the greater Ann Arbor area, but at a number of locations around the country. Maybe you can talk a little bit about any future performances that you already know that you have lined up out of state.
Sure. I had the wonderful opportunity just after I launched the program on Veterans Day in 2017 to be contacted by a foundation in Washington, D.C. called the Pitchpipe Foundation that was working with the Veterans Administration and sending me to veterans facilities throughout the country, which was just absolutely a wonderful way to begin. So I played in veterans facilities throughout the country. My current season began again on Veterans Day last year, and I've done 10 programs since then, and I probably have about 10 to 15 before I wind up this season in July. I will be playing, I just came back from some performances in Phoenix. I will be playing in Pensacola, Florida, a couple of programs in February, and in Memphis, Tennessee in March. In Nebraska, Hastings, Nebraska in April. And I'm doing a West Coast, Northwest tour in May. I'll be playing in Washington and Idaho, that region. Then coming back and touring Iowa, Minnesota area in June, and ending the season with some performances in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in July.
And all listeners, all of those dates can be found on his website at victoryvertical.com, where you can get more information about this unique Steinway piece of history and intersection with World War II, but also, more importantly, to be able to find where Dr. Gary Peterson of Eastern Michigan University is performing this program. And you won't pack up the car, bring the folks. You won't regret it at all. Gary, I really appreciate the work that you're doing here to keep this story going and alive. I'm sure Mr. Steinway is looking down smiling and would never have thought in sort of an offhand comment would lead to this, but you're doing great work, and we appreciate you taking some time to explain it to our listeners here on Veterans Radio today.
Thank you, Jim. It truly has been kind of a I'm becoming a little bit fanatical, but it's been a true pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Dr. Gary Peterson, professor of music at Eastern Michigan University, and his project, the Victory Verticals from the Steinway Music Company. Fascinating little piece of history that's been lost, but now has been resurrected and found and is being preserved both by the work that the professor is doing, and now preserved because we've made it part of our archives at veteransradio.net. People often ask, why do you spend so much time doing this to Dale or Bob or I? And bringing you these kinds of stories is exactly why we do it. Again, thank you to our sponsors, U.S. Wings, VVA Post 310, VFW Post 423, American Legion Post 46, and Legal Help for Veterans. We look forward to you joining us next Sunday on WHAM 1600 AM at 5 p.m. And on behalf of Veterans Radio, until next time, you are dismissed.